across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world, on the internet, by webcast and by podcast. My name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Unexplained. I absolutely promise to name check some of you and also address some of your emails in a future edition, but we've got a big show coming this time for you. It is with a man who has conducted a remarkable, I think, we'll see what you think, remote viewing project to view the inside of the Great Pyramid at Giza and to give us an insight, very literally, in how that pyramid was produced, how it was built. Over the years, Egyptologists and others have had their say about that. Everybody's theory seems to be different. What you are about to hear, based on Courtney Brown's new documentary, which I do recommend you see, I saw it myself last night and was pretty well blown away by it, this will change the way people think. Now, you may agree, you may disagree, but I can guarantee that what you're about to hear here will make you think. So Courtney Brown coming up. Thank you as ever to Adam Cornwell at Creative Hotspot in Liverpool for devising the website, maintaining it, making sure the show gets out to you. Just very quickly, had a lot of feedback on Edition 52, and I take your points. Remember, of course, whenever you say these things, the people we were talking to were not professional broadcasters, and they were not professional media users. And I guess we all learn by doing these things. A lot of you found the show interesting and some of you were a bit frustrated, and I can understand why, but I hope you also understand the reasons why they were perhaps not as, I'm trying to find a word for polished, as some people who are professional at the art of going in front of a microphone might be. But that is how we learn. This time, prepare to be amazed. Courtney Brown coming right up. If you want to contact me, send me an email. I love to get your feedback. Go to www.theunexplained.tv, www.theunexplained.tv. There you can send me an email, or please, if you can, make a donation to the show. Okay, let's cross to East Coast USA now and to remote viewer Courtney Brown. Courtney, thank you for coming on.
Howard, it's my great pleasure. I want to thank you so much for inviting me.
Now, Courtney, do I describe you personally as a remote viewer? What do I call you?
Well, I do know how to do remote viewing, and I've done it for many years, and so yes, I do that. But that's really not my role anymore at the Farsight Institute. I'm really the chief investigator. So I really am the one who sets up the projects, structures them, scopes them, sort of models them like an artist would model something out of clay. And then other people remote view. So people who do really nothing but that. So the people who we work with who are the remote viewers, they specialize in doing just that. And that's all they do. And they are literally the best on the planet Earth. So really, when you think of it this way. If you have somebody running a survey company, doing survey research with door-to-door interviews and things like that. Well, that door-to-door interview person, those people are specially trained on the day-by-day basis how to do everything, how to do sample design, how to do random sampling, how to do exactly what to do in terms of to get the stratified sample, get people out into the field and everyone. So everyone knows their special purpose. But the person who's running the whole thing has to have also done all those things as well, even though he or she may not be the specialist in that one thing. But he knows that whole part. Just like with any broadcast situation, if you see the person at the very top, the person probably went through everything else that was below, starting in the metaphorical mailroom and then moving back up.
A lot of them are accountants these days, though, Courtney.
Yeah. So anyway, you're right. So that's my situation. So I don't do the remote viewing anymore. I actually organize the projects and I do the analysis and then help with the presentation. The best way to think of me and my role at the Farsight Institute is as the front man. And look at it this way. The band Bon Jovi, well, the front man for that is John Bon Jovi. Aerosmith, the front man for Aerosmith is Steven Tyler. And it goes on and on. Bono is the front man for U2. So for the Farsight Institute, I'm the face that people see often, but I'm not the only thing at the Farsight Institute. We're a nonprofit organization dedicated to the study of the remote viewing phenomenon as it was done using the military or military-derived methodologies. But when I say that, we also have a board of directors, and I have been voted down on the board of directors sometimes with some of my projects. So we have, you know, I have to answer to people as well. And as a nonprofit, it's not owned by anyone. It's a public entity.
So it's truly democratic.
Yeah, it's truly democratic. People sometimes think that I'm the Farsight Institute, but that's because they see me so often presenting the case. The reality is I've lost votes on the board of directors, and you know, I have to justify everything that we do and so on.
That's good for the soul, I would guess. Now, I've had Major Ed Dames a number of times on my radio shows and on this online version of the show, so. Mm-hmm. I'm familiar with his version of remote viewing and the description that he's always given me whenever I've started off the show by asking him what is remote viewing. I think a lot of us have views of this mental cerebral technique used during the Cold War by the US and by the Russians as well, to see what is going on the other side, using the power of mind collecting, or rather connecting to the collective unconscious. Is that a fair description or is that wrong?
Well, I wouldn't use those words. I would not use those words. What I would say is that it's a mental procedure to transfer perceptual information across time and space. It was developed by the United States military and used for espionage purposes. In 1995, in November, the official programs were closed down, and everyone that I trust and respect assumes immediately that they started up another one and that it's going on bigger and better than ever today. And if that ever becomes public, they'll close that one down and say that was a rogue general. We don't know how it happened and start all over again.
Yeah, same old. But yeah, is there any evidence that the previous program, because it was so secretive for obvious reasons, that it was successful?
Well, yes, but you don't get people from the military really talking about, you know, some of the great successes. But, you know, the issue is that the program that happened up until 1995 was sort of a preliminary first start. And what we do at the Farsight Institute, we're the biggest civilian hub for full scientific remote viewing projects. So we're totally civilian. And what we can say now is what we do at the Farsight Institute far exceeds what was ever done in the military in the past. Now, we're not sure exactly what the military is doing right now, but I have heard stories that are really amazing. So, but what we do at the Farsight Institute exceeds by a vast space what was done up until November 1995. Now, that does not diminish what was done in the military. But the idea that the military has some type of pedigree, some type of special, you know, because it was the military, it's somehow special, that really has to be dismissed. It was just a group, and they discovered something. They figured out how to make it work in a primitive way, but good enough for government work. And then they used it, and without understanding how it worked. But now, as you know, as a civilian institute, we have been able to do much more. And when we go 20 years into the future, there will be other groups besides us that will look back and say, well, Farsight did some very interesting things, but we do things much differently and much better. And we've advanced much, you know, a great deal further. And 20 years after that, 40 years into our future, there'll be other groups that will say that they did it even better. So it's a continual process. But what we have now, we're at the absolute top of our game. We have the absolute best remote viewers on the planet Earth, bar none. And we have a way now to present the remote viewing information in a way that no one has ever done before, that requires no past knowledge for people to watch it, to see it, and to understand that the remote viewing process itself works. See, in the old days, they used pen and paper. Mm. That was the military methodology. They used pen on paper.
And the idea was to sketch whatever impressions came into your head, right?
Yeah, and you end up interpreting doodles and words and things like that, a lot of words. But what we have done is a couple major things is the best remote viewers that we work with, for example, Daz Smith and Dick Allgaier. Daz Smith is in the UK. And he does controlled remote viewing, which is the form of remote viewing that came out of the U.S. military. And Dick, in the DIA program, and Dick Allgaier uses the Hawaii Remote Viewers Guild. And that was taught to him by Glenn Wheaton who came out of Special Forces Intelligence. Now, Special Forces Intelligence, that was a different thing. That was more of an underground movement within the military that later became known as the 1st Earth Battalion and was featured in the movie, not the book, but the movie, Men Who Stare at Goats. Mm. With Jeff Bridges and George Clooney.
Yes, so I've interviewed the author. I know that book well and the movie.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was two separate, those are two separate things. The DIA thing was an official program, whereas the 1st Earth Battalion was an unofficial movement. But nonetheless, you got this remote viewing content coming out of both sides. So it's very interesting that the process we use now is you took the best remote viewers that were in the pen and paper method, and then they retrained to be able to do their sessions standing up live on video with no, they set up the video cameras themselves, nobody in the room that could lead them or whatever, under totally blind conditions, not knowing anything about the so-called target that they're supposed to perceive. And they do their sessions on whiteboards, standing up, and this is important, Howard, in a theatrically interesting manner, so that when you actually watch them, you don't need to know any of the arcane methodologies, the doodles or anything like that that happens with the remote viewing. What you do is you see them describing the target, facing the camera, being animated, and the descriptions and their activities are as clear as if they were there with their own, you know, in person with their own eyes and witnessing it.
So there is a certain theatricality about this. Do you think those people, and we'll talk about the project to do with the pyramid, of course, in just a second, but do you think that doing it in such a theatrical way means that they feel under pressure somehow to deliver when perhaps the results are a bit fuzzy?
No, it was just a matter of training to get to be able to do that. Because in the past, you really couldn't watch a good video of somebody doing remote viewing, sketching on a pen and with a pen and paper. It just looked boring and it wasn't interesting. And the average person just wasn't getting it because a lot of doodles that were on the paper, the special things that were done in the methodologies. But now you don't have to know anything about it. And you can just look at them, describe it on whiteboard. And the point is, it simply got to that level. Now, for example, consider music. Now, you look at somebody who's been studying music for a little while, and you go to their home and they play something on the piano. Well, they're sort of squinting and concentrating on the actual pieces of paper, the sheet music, and they're playing things in sort of a methodical way, and the music is sort of coming out okay. But then you go to see, then you go to hear and see Lang Lang perform in Carnegie Hall. And like his eyes are closing, he's moving, he's theatrical, he's emotional, he's charismatic, and the music is gorgeous. And you say, so that's what it's all about. Well, that's what the remote viewing is like now. Now, Daz Smith and Dick Allgaier do their sessions standing up live on video and interact with the audience as they're doing this and are under totally blind conditions. So the result is you look at the actual remote viewing as it's done and your jaw drops because you say, this isn't some strange little, you know, doodles that I'm interpreting. This is when Dick Allgaier describes the Great Pyramid of Giza. He calls it a pyramid. He draws it exactly. He describes a desert environment. Everything's perfect. When Daz Smith describes the manipulation of the large 80-ton granite stone blocks by workers in the assembly of the Great Pyramid of Giza, he's not like just interpreting crude doodles. He's drawing the blocks exactly and describing the workers, dark skin, minimal clothing, the environment, the whole situation, so that it's totally unambiguous. I should also say that Daz Smith is a graphical artist in Britain. And so he's trained as an artist. So when he draws something, it looks good. The stone blocks really have a three-dimensional view. It's great. And Dick Allgaier was a celebrity newscaster in Hawaii for many years. 30 years, in fact. And he actually just by chance happens to be a pretty good artist himself. He draws very well. So we have found that it's not just the ability to perceive things, but it's also the ability to be able to present things. So being able to draw, being an artist is important, and also being able to do this in front of a camera. So Dick Allgaier was the one who pioneered this because he lived 30 years of his life in front of a camera. So he was, being in front of a camera was natural to him. And he said, why should I do this on paper and pencil? I'm normally used to standing up and presenting things. So he was the one who started this process of transforming us from paper and pencil sitting at a desk to standing up, interacting with the audience live on video. and it worked great. And anyway, that's what we're doing now. And the reason it's so important is because the goal is to convince everyone that remote viewing is real, that the actual process of transferring information across time and space is a real phenomenon, and we now understand the physics behind it. I don't know if we'll have a chance to get into that, but maybe on another interview
I'd like to, and just to quote something from the top of the documentary, like I say, we'll get into that, but you say the data was gathered under impeccable scientific conditions, and that description you've just given me certainly attests to that, and from what I saw with my own eyes, it's very, very impressive. I want to ask you this before we start to talk about what's in the documentary and how you did it. As we record this, flight MH370, the Malaysian Airlines plane,
yes,
remains unlocated, although there have been various reports of beacons being detected. The Australians, the Chinese say that they found something. Now, by the time this is heard, possibly they'll have found wreckage. Possibly they'll have found the black box flight recorder indicated by the beacon. We don't know that. What I was curious about is, knowing that remote viewing exists, knowing there are practitioners like yourself in the world, how come a remote viewer, as far as we know, has not located MH370?
That's a good question. I can only speak for what we do here at the Farsight Institute, okay? When we do projects, they're full-blown scientific projects. It takes us a long while to do. The Great Pyramid of Giza took us a year to get done. The project before that, dealing with an underwater anomaly 1,000 miles west of the coast of Portugal and Morocco, that took us a year to do as well. Now, we're actually trying to speed up the process so we have one project done every 2 months, and we're in fact in the middle of one right now. But the issue is that what we do is we set up the projects. I have to design the targets. It takes me a while to sort of get everything exactly just right. And then we have to assign the remote viewing. And then when the remote viewing gets started, the remote viewers are just given a non-leading email. They don't talk to me about it. They don't see me face to face. And they get a non-leading email saying, there is a target, remote view it, send me the session, period. And so then they have to do it. Now remember, we're all volunteers. So it takes a while, sometimes a couple months, in terms of the Giza project or the previous project dealing with the underwater anomaly, it was like 4, 5, 6 months sometimes to get all of the sessions in. They're not just one or two sessions. They're like a lot of sessions going after various elements of the target. And then there's an analysis period, and then we have to, we don't just throw the data up on the website. We have to produce a video documentary to explain it to people so that they can get the whole thing. So you're talking the better part of a year. Now, for us to do something really quick like that, it just doesn't fit in. And by the time we actually went after trying to discover what the Malaysian airliner, what happened to it, just like you said, by the time this thing broadcasts, they may have already found it. It may be old news. So we don't do current events. Now, there's another reason why we don't do current events. If I started to do current events, if I started to give current events as targets to these viewers, then they would start looking at the newspaper and say, oh, I wonder if this is the next thing. Every big story, for example, the Malaysian airliner, that's the big story right now. So and they'd all know that. If they knew I was giving current events, how could it be blind? They would have that worry that maybe this is the Malaysian airliner target. So I sort of have a line drawing, which is they will never get current events, so they don't worry about that.
And
that
even if, sorry for interrupting, Courtney, but even if somebody from one of the rescue services or somebody connected with the investigation contacted you and said, look, we are desperate here, can you do anything for us? You wouldn't be able to do it because of those complexities you've just talked about.
There's a lot of people who do this remote viewing stuff, especially military people, who do this sort of on the fly, spur of the moment, stuff like that. But you asked the question yourself, Howard, why hasn't there been a remote viewer that does that? When you do this spur of the moment, off the cuff, on the fly type of stuff, generally speaking, the results are often quite crappy. They're just not very good. The stuff that we do at the Farsight Institute takes an enormous amount of preparation, an enormous amount of effort for execution, and finally analysis and everything. And the stuff that we do is absolutely first rate. There's a quality difference between that. So you can't just sort of say, go to a remote viewer, find this, answer this, I need the answer by 2 o'clock. you can do that to the person, but that's just not what we do. And if I saw that happen, I'm sure I'd look at the session, see if there's anything interesting in it. But the panic involved in getting the data, the aura of actually telling the remote viewer that you actually assign targets that are in the news, so they're probably thinking about it in the first place. You know, all of that makes for a much lower quality thing. Now, the military did want to use it for stuff like that. They wanted to know on the ground when troops were in the battlefield, you know, what was over the hill. They wanted to use it under battlefield conditions. And some of the experiments that I've heard about are extraordinary, where they actually have remote viewers in the United States guiding people on the battlefield. I mean, they're actually trying to do it by actually sending information as well as getting information. They're doing all types of crazy experiments, but they're interested in doing this sort of the way you're suggesting, which is something's happened, we want it done right now. But the quality that you get is not the type of stuff you really want to use for convincing a whole planet that we're more than physical beings and we're not alone in this galaxy.
Understood. Now, if I want to come off this in just a while, because to be fair to you, we're talking about your documentary and I really do want to get into that. One final point, which will only take a second to get rid of, but if you were asked to view what it was like on that airliner, whatever happened to it, and at this moment we don't know, would that be possible? If you had the time, if you had the teams, if you did it with the disciplines that you prefer, could you do that?
Yeah, we could get the entire story, and it would be a really good quality thing. I mean, it would be perfect. You'd know detail by detail what exactly happened from the moment they took off to the moment whatever happened to them. However, time really is an illusion. You are literally transferring perceptual information across time and space. That means everything is happening simultaneously. And the physics of this we now understand. And on another broadcast, if you want, I'd be willing and very happy to talk about how we know now the science actually works on the basic level of scientific principles. But what would basically happen is we don't need to have the answer. Look, whatever happened to those people, it's already happened. If they're dead, they're dead. So using the remote viewing right now in a panicky situation isn't going to help them. It'll just help the information of what people want to know. If we wait 5 years, something like that, and the thing is still a mystery and it looks like it's going to stay a mystery, then we could assign that project and we'd get the same information that you're asking about now, but it would be much higher quality, meaning we don't have to have it right now. We're not going to be saving lives by having that information right now. And so if you do it in a proper time, in a proper context, you will still get the exact same information, but it'll be much better. It'll
Understood.
Be really fully flowed, fleshed out.
Let's get to the Pyramid of Giza and your pretty amazing documentary. This is something that you could almost say has been thousands of years in the making, the project I'm saying. At the top of the documentary, you say this, what you hear and the data that is going to be presented before you will turn the world upside down. What do you mean by that?
Well, there are two things. The first is the remote viewing phenomenon itself, and then the second is what actually happened thousands of years ago when those pyramids were actually built. So on the level of remote viewing has been sort of publicly known since the mid-1990s. And it has not, there are millions of websites that sort of mention it now, but it has not fundamentally affected mainstream. The mainstream science, it's not taught in any university. You know, I am a university professor, a tenured university professor. I'm a mathematician that works using applied mathematics in a social science program at Emory University. But I do not teach any remote viewing related stuff there. I just do math. But remote viewing and its content, even though it's now completely understandable as a real phenomenon, is not taught even in any type of peripheral way, even in any university setting anywhere. So after all of these years of working with the remote viewing phenomenon, with the military people out there doing it and the civilian stuff that we do out there, it's not hit the mainstream. So the reality was, in order to actually bridge the gap so that finally the mainstream news, New York Times, BBC, CNN, things like that, actually present this as a real thing, we have to be able to show remote viewing in a way that's so unambiguous, so conclusive, so proof-oriented that that you don't need the authorities to tell you that it's real, that anybody can look at it and say, I don't need any authority to tell me what to think. I can see it with my own eyes. So disclosure that remote viewing is real, we don't have to depend on authorities to do it. Authorities don't do disclosure anyway. For example, President Obama just 3 weeks ago was the first president ever to acknowledge publicly that Area 51 exists. Now, they have tour buses that go through the Sierra, that go by Area 51.
They do.
Everybody knows Area 51. Authorities only acknowledge something when it becomes a laughing matter because the entire world thinks they're ridiculous. At that point, they'll acknowledge something.
And that is a point that you make very powerfully at the head of the documentary, and I was very, very struck by it because I thought, this guy's right. Official organizations, governments, they don't do disclosure. So if you're waiting for them to do it for you, you need to wait a long time and practically forget it.
And it's even worse than that, because when the military did release the remote viewing stuff, they purposely wanted it to stay in the New Age community, which is like putting it in a, and I'm not trying to be derogative towards certain people here, but it's like putting it in a metaphorical leper colony, because the New Age community won't be touched by the mainstream. So it'll stay there, and it's like, it's better than putting it in a prison. If you actually lock it up and say it's a secret, you're going to get all types of people trying to find out about this secret, and it'll come out. But if you put it in the New Age community, it's sealed, it's permanent, it's done. And then there's the woo-woo and laughable factor, and that's where they wanted to keep it.
And you can guarantee by doing that there is always a question mark over it.
Exactly. But now when you do remote viewing, and it's done on video, live, with nobody else in the room, under perfectly blind conditions, and the descriptions are... you don't have to know anything about the methodologies. The descriptions are so perfect. It's as if an artist went back in time, saw what was happening, came back, and literally was simply describing what he saw, he or she saw. And it's not the slightest bit worse quality than if they had physically seen it with their own eyes. So it's that good. That's why we are now at the very top of our game. And again, this is not top of our game. That does not diminish what was done in the early military days. And it does not diminish what we're doing now when we say in 20 years, people will be doing much more.
So, are the remote viewers involved in this? And for this project, you used the team to do this. And very impressive it is. We've said that. Do they see pictures in their heads, or do they get impressions? Or is it a mix of the two?
It's a mix of the two, but they actually do see pictures. And so... Now, Dad Smith, he's in Bath in Britain. So, you know, he'd be a good person to, you might want to interview.
Hey, well, listen, that's not too far away from me. That's about an hour and a half, 2 hours drive from here. Yeah. And I could easily go and see him. So I'd like to.
Well, he and Dick Allgaier are, in my opinion, the absolute best remote viewers on the planet Earth. So you have in UK something that nobody else has. You have like the best of the best right there, an hour and a half away from you. So the point, and Dick Allgaier is even harder for me because he's in Hawaii. Now, so actually, can you repeat the question again, Howard? I got lost.
Yeah, I asked you about whether they saw pictures, they got impressions.
Well, basically what it is this. You have, what they do is they get, there's two types of pictures they see in their mind. The brain, and we can cover this more thoroughly if you interview me about the science of remote viewing, but the brain is essentially acting as a very sophisticated hologram generator. We live in a frequency-based universe. Everything, the physicists have never discovered ever anything solid inside your desk and car, and everything is just molecules. Inside that, there's atoms. Inside that, there's subatomic particles. And inside every one of those, they've just frequencies. They've never found a solid billiard ball type of thing ever. And so what we basically have is just frequencies. And so all of the pictures that we see, the reality that we see, is all based on waves. And so what the brain actually is, it's a very sophisticated hologram generator that selects out certain frequencies that it wants you to see. And it screens out absolutely everything else. So you need to see the lion that's in front of you today from an evolutionary perspective. You don't need to see the gazelle that was there yesterday, and you don't need to see the elephant that's there tomorrow. You need to see the lion that's there today if you're going to survive. So the brain is really good, just like a radio. A good radio is really good at screening out all other broadcasts except the one that you're tuned in on. But the other ones are still there. there. So what happens is there's the remote viewer is trained to allow certain things into the brain. They basically fiddle with their own training, their own perceptions, so that they train the brain to allow things in. And then they get to be really good at it. So the brain sort of knows it's okay to let in these other things. So some of the images they see are sort of vague, foggy, and fuzzy, especially in the beginning of remote viewing training. It's really very much that way. But then when the remote viewers get really good at it, they essentially ignore the stuff that they're seeing with their own eyes, and they just focus mentally on these images, and they get to be fairly good at really saying, my gosh, look at this. As if they're seeing it in their own mind's eye. The image, if you were to compare it with a physical image is very bright, high resolution image coming in through the eyes. And then a remembered image, if you bring up a memory of something, that is less clear, less high resolution, a little bit translucent, things like that. Well, the remote viewing images are foggier, fuzzier than that. But if you get good at focusing on them, they sort of come into focus. The brain sort of relaxes, lets the frequencies in, and you can see it. Now, there are certain procedures that you actually see people like Dick Allgaier doing. You wouldn't recognize that he's doing this, but occasionally he'll close his eyes and he'll look up. And what he's actually doing is creating in his mind a blackboard, just like a schoolroom blackboard, but it's a black surface. And he's letting his mind instantly transfer an image onto that blackboard. And so he'll close his eyes, look up, and in the documentary, you can actually see him do that from time to time. And that image is often extremely high resolution. Trouble is, it goes very quickly. It goes flash, it's gone. And so he's good at being able to see it right away as long as it's there, and then opens his eyes and quickly draws it. So that's called the blackboard technique, and that's really, that was developed by the Hawaii Remote Viewers Guild procedures that was taught to him by Glenn Wheaton. So that's a special forces intelligence thing. But we have used it in our, we have with the methodologies that we actually have also at the Far State Institute called the scientific remote viewing, we have actually stolen that and we use that as well now because it's a really great extra thing. So those
and they came up with some amazing results for the way that things were done and who were in, yeah. You know, what sort of people or beings were involved in doing them. But you also set questions like, what was the pyramid for? Now, that's not something that you can specifically see, but you can tell a story, a narrative around that, yeah?
You have to connect the dots. Now, there are two types of remote viewing data in all projects. The first type is verifiable. Those are data that are clearly described in the target that they're supposed to be describing when they do their sessions. And the descriptions that come back in the remote viewing data have to exactly match what's in the target. Now, in this case, the verifiable stuff is the pyramid itself. So the remote viewers have to describe a pyramid exactly as it looks. And then they also had to describe the blocks, the big stone blocks. And they also had to describe the mining of the stone blocks. So all of this is verifiable components. And then there's new information. And the new information is information that they tell us that makes sense, but we didn't know that before. So we knew the pyramid exists. We knew the stone blocks were there. We know that where the quarries were. We know that they were mined. So that information is verifiable. And that can be done to prove remote viewing exists. And the way it's done now with the remote viewing process live on video, anybody can see it. And so the next question is, what do you do with the new information? Because that's not verifiable. But that is, we have to consider it speculative until there's some type of verifiable physical confirmation of it. But what we can say is it physically matches what we see on the ground today. And the theories of mainstream science, those explanations for what we see on the ground today are totally ludicrous.
Well, in fact, a lot of scientific explanation, as we know over the years, a lot of work in London has been done about the pyramids. There are many gaps in our knowledge. What you present to us here with the remote viewing is ways that these things can be achieved. For example, high energy tools being used to effectively melt rock to make the pieces geometrically perfect in a way that, knowledge, then you wouldn't assume they could do that, but that's exactly what happened. The thing is aligned to the stars in a perfect way. You talk about that. And also you talk about the sort of, in Japan, they have a thing called the maglev train, don't they? Magnetic levitation. Yes. The way that they moved the giant rocks. Nobody's ever been able to totally adequately explain how people with supposedly that level of sophistication, which wasn't where we are at, supposedly, how they could have moved those giant rocks in a 20-year project to create something so huge.
You know, and the theories of mainstream science of how they did it is really so amazingly stupid, I don't know where to begin, which is that they took crude hammers and chisels, went to the quarry walls, which is like a cliff, and made some cracks, and then took wood chips and put those wood chips in the cracks and then sprayed water on them. And then the water expanded with the wood chips, and then the cracks and the rocks cracked out of the cliff. Well, if you think that's possible to do with an 80-ton block of granite that's the size of a school bus or bigger, and you know, you just go to a cliff face yourself and find some wood chips and put them in a crack and throw water on it and tell me if the mountain cracks open. I mean, it's just so stupid, I don't know where to begin. And the only way that they have to cut not only the four sides perfectly with total precision, this is not sloppy workmanship, but they also have to slice it on top and they have to slice it on the bottom. How are they going to do that with wood chips? I mean, it just is mind-boggling that story actually sold. And then when they say they had to move the big stone blocks, let's say they somehow did cut them perfectly so that they're absolutely smooth sides, no variations in the middle. And then they just say, that, well, they put them on some logs and rolled them to the river. Oh, give me a break. They couldn't have even lifted those things up. And then the question is, what do they do with it once they get it to the river? They put it on a reed boat or a wood boat. I mean, Howard, at what point do we just stop thinking about this and start laughing?
Well, for years, there have been too many things that don't add up, but it's the typical story of science, isn't it? We have to get together a paradigm to explain things. Otherwise, we start feeling uneasy about ourselves because there is stuff that we don't know and stuff that doesn't add up. Now, one of the things that the remote viewers say, and we don't want to give away the entire content of your project, that wouldn't be fair.
Oh, no, it's okay. We can talk about anything.
Good. Okay, well, let's do it. They say that there was ET involvement, and there is a view of one of the creatures that is particularly chilling. It is the large bug-eyed creature, but the creature is described as, and I've got the word here in my notes, demonic.
Yeah, in fact, Dick Allgaier, that was a very unusual thing because Dick Allgaier had already described the pyramid itself, all the verifiable information, the mining stuff. It was just flawless. And then he noted that the workers that were used for mining were different from the workers that were used for assembly. The workers that were used for assembly of the pyramid were like you and I, normal humans. But for mining, humans would have been killed instantly with the toxic fumes, because you're using these energy type of tools to melt, to slice like Star Wars weapons, to melt and slice these huge blocks right out of the quarry walls, and that produced volcanism, that produced liquid rock, which is, you, for example, if you go to the edge of a volcano, you can't breathe the fumes that are coming out of there, you die instantly. So these people that were actually used to do the mining were actually, they were shorter and they were clones. They were genetically manipulated to be able to withstand some of those mining conditions a little bit better. And they also had some filtration masks involved as well. But the issue is somebody had to actually grow them. And so then it was a natural thing for Dick to say, okay, where did these things come from? So on his own, he just followed the breadcrumbs and he found the fetuses in like these containers. And there was a caretaker or an overseer who was an extraterrestrial. And we have never seen in any of these data any extraterrestrials personally standing next to humans. So we assume that the extraterrestrial manipulation of the human was being done behind the scenes. So that the humans probably didn't even know that they were their own actions, especially the elite, didn't know that their own actions were probably actually being sort of guided by somebody else.
We and don't some really of this really was done it. Under the mask of a kind of false religious belief that the ETs fostered.
The whole pyramid project looks like it was part of what we might call a prison project, which is the pyramids are totally useless. They're a pile of rocks. They have no shelter capability, nothing whatsoever. They were enormously expensive to build in terms of life, you know, life and death, suffering. And it's like what you would have with a prison. where people are given a sledgehammer and told to go out and bang those rocks. And at the end of the day, they're exhausted, they're too tired to think about revolt or escape. And that seems to have been much of the project. And in addition, they put a religion on that. The extraterrestrials sort of got them into thinking. It was brainwashing at its best, Howard. So what you got was a religion where people were really not able to think of their own destiny, of how they would normally do things. And so you got an architecture that was weird, a religion that was weird, and people sort of going off in the wrong track of how they would normally do things. And the real question is, why were the extraterrestrials doing this? Now, very interestingly, Dick Allgaier, when he did find that extraterrestrial that he calls the praying mantis lady, she was telepathically very aware, and she could actually see him. Now, we do know that this is possible because we have had numerous situations, even going back to the old military days, where a remote viewer would actually see another remote viewer at a target. They sort of leave like a ghostly image, even if it was done like years previously, it sort of stays there. And so we do have situations in which extraterrestrials in particular have been noticed to be able to see and point at a remote viewer when a remote viewer is actually watching them. So this lady, praying mantis lady, actually saw Dick Allgaier watching them, and she was not pleased. And this is the first time, to my knowledge, ever that a real live interaction between a human and an extraterrestrial was caught on video.
My listeners would say, what proof do we have of that? You have one side of the video, don't you? You have the remote viewer side.
That's exactly right. And it's also not verifiable. So remember, there's two types of data, the verifiable stuff and the new stuff. So this qualifies as the new stuff. So it has to stay speculative, but it fits in with the entire picture. And it fits in a lot better than the crazy ideas that mainstream science says on how those things were actually made. So it was no joke that a huge amount of effort, energy, everything was used to create this project of the pyramids. So cloning specialized beings, specialized humanoids, in order to do the mining operation is not extraordinary given the amount of resources that were put into creating this project in the first place.
Now, the person behind the project, supposedly from the viewing, is a man with a very serious illness, supported by a powerful woman, and they have connections with extraterrestrials. That's a fascinating story in itself.
Yeah, that really is. Now, we don't actually see the humans interacting with the extraterrestrials. So we have really good descriptions. By the way, the descriptions fit perfectly the type of setting and the type of people that would be in a pharaoh type of setting. So if you're talking about the type of elite that you would get in ancient Egypt during the time of the pyramids, that's exactly what's described. So it was clearly a situation where you had this royalty type, and some of the descriptions, in fact, by Dick Allgaier, of the types of people that were involved in the elite are bone-chillingly fleshed out. I mean, they're just really very clear. And some people were not so good, and some people were good. He has physical descriptions of what they were like. And there was somebody that was near death. And
this sounds to me as if there was as much plotting and scheming as ancient Rome. And that's just among the human beings.
Absolutely. It looks just like that. And it actually matches with a lot of what mainstream archaeologists say, sort of the intrigue, the palace intrigue that they say was going on in the pharaoh's chambers. It actually matches that type of level of personal intrigue, soap opera drama.
So, Courtney, you say that these humans had no personal contact with the ETs, but the ETs were involved. If that is so, how was the technology obtainable?
Now, that's very interesting, because some of the ET contact, some of the ET stuff was open in plain view. For example, the method of levitating the blocks. It was clear, Daz Smith described how the blocks were actually levitated, the actual distance that they were over the ground. They were 18 inches to 24 inches over the ground, and the workers were manipulating them. So the workers themselves, he said, didn't know how the technology was done. All I knew is that the stone blocks were floating, and they were supposed to push them into place with no real physical effort, just guiding them, manipulating them into place. But they were sort of dumb about how it was actually done. Now, clearly some of the technology from mining also was clearly extraterrestrial or off-world type of advanced technology. But also the people who were doing the mining were disposable people. They were people that were just genetically engineered. Dick Allgaier described them as having very limited mental capabilities. And they were simply discarded, disposed of afterwards. So there were essentially no witnesses to the mining afterwards. They were gone. And so we have the people doing the assembling that really weren't asking questions for why these stone blocks were there, why they were floating. And secondly, you have no real witnesses to the other technology, the AT technology that were used for the mining, because they were all killed off. So what you essentially have is a situation where some of the technology looks like it would have been in plain view, but you don't have any data coming through these sessions of the extraterrestrials being visible to the humans when the technology was being used or whatever.
But somebody must have been an intermediary between us and them.
It could very easily, we don't know, this is speculative, but it could very easily have been that the extraterrestrials were intellectually, mentally manipulating the elite to do things. And some of the people were perhaps not asking questions. Some of the people were thinking it was perhaps magic when they pointed a large stick at the rocks and the rocks were floating. We don't really know. This is all speculative, but we do know that the rocks were floated. They were levitated when they were manipulated into place. Nobody had to lift them up and put them onto a boat. And
let's face it, as you've just alluded, conventional scientific explanations just don't cut it when it comes to that.
They're absolutely ludicrous. Nothing makes sense with respect to what they say conventional. The stories that conventional science says, mainstream science says, and how the pyramids were built just don't match the facts on the ground even slightly. And what we came out with in this documentary, The Great Pyramid of Giza, it does match what we see on the ground.
Now, how did this power source that created this amazing energy range of tools, how, as far as you know, were the people involved in all of this, I say people, but you know what I'm saying, how were they able to plug into it? Because the way that it's described in the documentary looks as easy as plugging into a 110 volt wall socket.
Yeah, obviously they had huge energy resources, both in order to do the mining. And if you look at for example, if you look at Dick Allgaier's descriptions of how the bedrock was cracked so to produce like a pit so you could go down and sort of horizontally get at some of the rocks.
Amazing.
It was amazingly clear how he described that.
And this was this is right at the head of the documentary, right in the first few minutes. They created a pit to put the thing in and around. And the forces that they used, as described, were utterly monumental. Quite literally.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was also clean energy. It acted sort of like a nuclear bomb would act in Nevada when they would detonate a subterranean nuclear bomb and produce like a burp on the ground that you could see on the surface, and then the collapse, and you have a pit.
But do you think this technology is lost? Do you think this power source, this energy source, this harmonic energy you talk about, do you think somebody has access to this now?
On Earth, I have no idea, but it's clearly an accessible technology. And we do have procedures called technology transfer procedures that we don't have the resources to really sort of go after this type of stuff. But there is no technology that's lost, meaning you could go back in time and actually watch the technology. The thing to do is to do something like that, you have to have people who are actual scientists and engineers do the remote viewing. So they have to be trained in the remote viewing to the point where they're really good. And then you send them back, because you can see anything, but you have to understand what you're looking at. So if you send back a scientist and engineer, they could sort of figure it out. And then they also have to be good in terms of being trained as artists to be able to describe things and so on. But that nothing, when you said, is that thing lost? Nothing is lost, because nothing in time and space is inaccessible. We can see that.
Okay, and I'm inclined to agree with you there. It is totally mind-blowing, but the one feeling that I had above all others as I watched the documentary was that this makes everything fit together in a way that I've certainly never seen before. If we're talking paradigms here, it's the best one that I've ever come across and is worthy of more investigation. One of the things that comes out from what you say is something that a lot of researchers have hinted at over the years, and that is that this pyramid, this giant pyramid and the other pyramids are not just about honoring the dead and burying them, but they're about communication, yeah?
Yeah, actually that communication element seems to have been part of the religion, meaning the religion seems to have been oriented towards making a statement to the universe that they are there developing. But, you know, what we do know from the data that came in, and Dad Smith describes this really clearly in the documentary, is that a second group of extraterrestrials came when many of the pyramids were finished, but some of them were not quite finished, and disrupted the first group of extraterrestrials. So there was two groups. Now, there was no evidence of a space battle in these data, so it may be that they were just sort of chased off, the first group. And the second group seemed to be much more friendly, and they apparently didn't like what was going on, and they introduced new ideas to the society. And within a matter of just a few years, like 10 years, the entire thing just sort of, all the people migrated away. They just sort of disappeared. They went away. The whole Egyptian society simply collapsed.
Well, that is a potential flaw in all of this, because if such amazing technology was used to do this and somebody had the ability to harness that, how come these people died out? In other words, you know, if they were so clever, where did they go?
The first group of extraterrestrials?
Hmm.
Oh, actually, that's a really good question, Howard. We don't know what they're doing now. Remember, time and space don't exist. So if we have the ability to transfer perceptual information across time and space, then it's only a matter of time before we figure out how to do this technologically. And then you're talking about, physicists don't differentiate between information and energy, and E equals MC squared, energy and mass are equivalent. So what we're talking about is the ability of time travel. And so any advanced extraterrestrials that could have gotten here in the first place would know the physics necessary to do this type of thing. The other thing is, we don't know what they're doing now. And I want to raise another question for you, Howard, that's very interesting. When we did the earlier project, so-called Atlantis, the true story of the underwater anomaly, we found no evidence in that documentary of humans being a warring tribal type of group that were battling each other all the time. So if you look at the 20th century, you have all the major wars, World War I, World War II, Korean War, Vietnam War, and then you have the first Desert Storm, and then you have the second invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan and 9/11. You have all of these things happening, and you have to ask, are we crazy? Are we nuts? Are we just, how could we possibly survive as a human, as a species, if we just fight like this all the time? And one of the thoughts that actually has entered my mind is, if there were extraterrestrials back in the old days who wanted to control the development of humanity so that it wouldn't go in a certain direction for whatever reason, and if they were disrupted, if their plans were disrupted, what would be the next thing? Sort of the next thing that would happen would be like guerrilla warfare, disrupt in another way. And so one thing that I really wonder about is, all of these wars that we fight, are they because we're dysfunctional or defective? Or is it because, I mean, look at the whole Holocaust thing, the craziness of Hitler. Is it because we're nuts as a species? Or is it because there's somebody messing with us, or perhaps some leadership? Now, we have sort of an example in the ancient Egypt days where it looks like the extraterrestrials were good at manipulating the leadership, the human leadership, into doing things like creating huge pyramid projects. Well, if they could do that to that leadership, what could they do to our current leadership?
That's a massively frightening thought, isn't it? Because that means that they have such capability, we are almost, well, we're not just almost, we are completely powerless to stop them intervening, if you follow that line of thought.
We're not powerless, because apparently the other extraterrestrials that came by don't have a complete ability to control the first one, but they have enough ability to keep it suppressed. So that's why our architecture looks different now. We don't build pyramids anymore. We don't build rock structures anymore. We build skyscrapers with metal buildings and things. That's apparently what we're normally like. That's what the architecture used to look like that was now on the anomaly that's 3 miles deep, 1,000 miles west of Morocco and Portugal, buried under the Atlantic Ocean. When that was on the surface, Europe didn't end in Portugal. Europe went 1,000 miles into the ocean, and that part sunk. But that's a different documentary, that's a different project. And we know the full story of that. But the basic idea is that that architecture looks like our architecture. Humans normally evolved to look like the way we are today. So with all of these UFO sightings and everything else that's going on, the extraterrestrials are clearly not allowing that first group to take over. But it's a question. I'm not stating this as a fact. It's just something I wonder about. Are they still messing with us in sort of on the edges? That's a really good question.
Well, you could ask that question about climate change, couldn't you?
You could ask that question about so many things that seem weird, so many things that seem like we're self-destructive. Is it normal? Or is it somebody messing with us? The point is they don't have the ability to completely control us. That's clear. So our future is good. And it's positive. But the issue is, why are we doing all of these things? So in terms of destructive stuff. So I'm sort of thinking, you know, are they still around or were they banished for good? I leave that as an open question that I don't have a solid answer for right now, Howard.
Okay, now, we've looked at the pyramids. We've only skirted over the salient points of the documentary. There's much more to see there, and I do recommend that if your appetite has been whetted for this, then you give it a try, because it is fascinating. It did fascinate me, and I'm not easily fascinated. Have you ever been tempted to ask the question of your remote viewing team, what's been going on Mars? If you look at the pictures from the current explorer up there, the rover up there, you see a lot of stuff that, maybe it's just our brains trying to rationalize it, but looks like rubble, doesn't it?
Yeah, let me say that we did do a Mars project. And this was hard because we had guys from the military, Glenn Wheaton and Lynn Buchanan, on our board of directors. So major projects had to be approved by them. And so I had to really work hard to squeeze this one in. But there was an anomaly that came out on NASA JPL Malin Space Science Systems photographs that was really clear. I mean, really clear. There was a spray, a very clear spray, coming out of a nozzle, a horizontally placed long nozzle that had a pipeline connected to it going into a dome. I showed them the pictures and I said, come on guys, let me do this. This is a verifiable target. You can see it right there. It's high resolution. It came from the NASA Malin Space Science Systems JPL websites. Let me just do this. It's a verifiable target. We don't know what it is. And they said, okay. I wiped the sweat off my brow. And so, because, you know, they could see the picture as well. We did that project, and that project is available to see for free on our website. It's and by the way, let me just mention what our website is, which is the Farsight Institute, and that's farsight.org, because we're a nonprofit. And if you look at the nav bar, you'll see one of the projects that we have there is Base on Mars. So when we went there, we sent a whole large team of the planet's best remote viewers in to look at that spray. They came back with the whole story. Totally blind conditions, done under perfect squeaky clean setup. They described the spray, the chemical composition of the spray, the nozzle, the pressure, the pipeline, the domes, and the presentation of that is available for free. You can just go
onto
our website.
And they did that without prompting.
They only get an email saying there's a target, send me the session, end the story, nothing else, period, full stop, over. And they come back with everything. And you can see that if you just click on Base on Mars. It turned out to be that there is a base on Mars that was created a long, 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 long time ago by other people, who knows well, ancient. And the current inhabitants are humanoid. They look like you and me. And they are using the base, and it's a hardship post for them. The whole story came out. They wear uniforms like white suits, but also some military uniforms, but also like white lab coats. And even their recreation stuff, the remote viewers came out with, in terms of they have recreation time. There's more men than women. It's considered a hardship post, but they're working and they're trying to resurrect the stuff that's in the base. And they have problems getting spare parts. It's a whole type of, it's a big, long story.
So this is happening now. How come, well, silly question, how come NASA doesn't know this?
Oh, they know it for sure. In fact, let me tell you, this is, can I show you proof of this? If you go to the website, farsight.org, and click on Base on Mars, you'll see on the top of it, you'll see the video presentation of me giving a presentation at Boulder, Colorado. That's, you know, the University of Boulder, Colorado is, they're out there, and I was giving a presentation of this whole thing. And you can watch the presentation. But underneath that, you'll see the actual pictures coming from the Malin Space Science Systems, NASA JPL website, so you can actually see the spray and the shadow underneath it. It is a very high resolution picture, there's no question. And under that, you will see the Google Earth picture of the same exact spot. And the Google Earth picture is seen by billions of people, of course, and that's been censored. So you actually see the exact spot on Mars, and you see the Google Earth image, and it's got a rectangle right around it, and it's all streaked out. It's on the exact spot. So the point is, in order to see the original image, and we know that they actually have the real photographs, because we have the original photographs, but that you have to dig out of the Malin Space Science Systems, JPL, NASA websites. So only a few people get to see that because you have to find it. But Google Earth is accessible. The Mars option of Google Earth is accessible to everybody. And so when you actually see it, you can actually clearly see that they know full well what's there because they censored it.
If you know all this and they know all this, how come in this very worrying world that we inhabit, Courtney, nobody's tried to stop you?
Well, there's two things that you have to understand. We have tried to, they did in the early years of Farsight. They were worried about us. And then we decided to be very quiet and just to do scientific research and not to be too public about it. Some people wondered if we still existed, but we were actively investigating. And then when we became more public, we had two of the military guys on our board of directors. So we tried to obey the rules. We did what we wanted to do. And we presented things in terms of scientific venues. And the other thing, and this is probably very important, that we did a couple things that really helped the military, that really helped the authorities a lot. And those are not well known, but we did them and they were sort of public and we were highly ridiculed by them because we did some things that really, really were hugely important, saved a lot of, I can't go into the details.
Did you help to locate Osama bin Laden?
No, we didn't do anything like that. And so, but those things, but basically is there's an element of goodwill in the intelligence community with respect to us. It's not a monolithic. The intelligence people and the authorities are not a single-minded group. They are actually quite complex. They're intelligent people. They have families just like you and I. They are very interested in the benefit of humanity, and they're mixed. Some people say Farsight should be shut down, and others say, no, we need this for the future. And so we are still here, and now we're doing things that are really, really, really interesting. Also, there's a good sizable chunk of people in the intelligence as well as the authorities that actually know that this stuff is going to come out. And so we are actually serving a huge public interest purpose to allow some of this information out. Remember the day after Roswell that was put out by Colonel Corso? That was a huge revelatory book, and it was never debunked or denied by the military. And this was a colonel who did that. So they let that out. They want some information to get out because they know there has to be a transition. There's a resistance to the information coming out, but they also know that it has to come out eventually. So we're serving a very useful purpose in that realm. On the other hand, what is really shocking, really amazing, Howard, is that after all of these years, nearly 20 years, I'm still the only academic in the entire planet that studies the remote viewing phenomenon as it's done using military or military-derived methodologies. Meaning, my entire set of colleagues are unbelievable. I don't know how to describe them. Do we describe them as cowards? Do you describe them as idiots? I mean, at what point do you get even one more person to say, this is fascinating? Now, I was speaking with John Mack, the late John Mack, mm-hmm. who was a professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. The author of the best biography of T. Lawrence, and he just said, you know, I have no idea why he was dragged through an academic inquisition at Harvard where they tried to revoke his tenure, and that was finally pulled by the dean, and so he survived. But he said, I have no idea why none of my colleagues at Harvard aren't also interested in this. This stuff is really fascinating. Why aren't they even interested in looking at this stuff? It's like really cool. And he was studying the so-called abduction phenomenon related to the UFOs and so on. And that was a really interesting question. And I ask that question still today. Out of all of the hundreds of thousands of academics on the entire planet, Howard, why am I still, after 20 years, the only one that's sticking my neck out and putting this up?
Well,
now, I'm enjoying.
Maybe
I'm
you're
enjoying
the
this.
Only one that we know about.
Well, I'm enjoying the spotlight. I'm enjoying the, well, you know, there's nobody public. Otherwise, we'd see their venues. So I'm enjoying the spotlight, and I'm enjoying the time. It's sort of like playing a football game, and all of the opposition, the opposing team has been cleared off, and I'm told, take the ball and run towards the goal. I mean,
and you can score as much as you like, and you certainly have with what you're doing at the moment.
So,
the documentary. Sure, the documentary, well worth seeing. I'm sorry that we're out of time. I think there are at least another two or three shows in you if you're willing to come back with me and
I'd
go through this again.
I'd love to come back.
I really, really enjoyed that. And, you know, your work, to me, is breathtaking. My audience will decide what they think, but keep it up. That's all I can say.
Howard, it's been an honor. I'd love to come back. And it's been a really interesting and useful, helpful interview.
One word after that. Wow. What do you think? Courtney Brown there with his amazing project. We'll have a link to his work at my website, www.theunexplained.tv. www.theunexplained.tv. Our website designed and honed by Adam Cornwell at Creative Hotspot in Liverpool. We have more great guests coming soon here at The Unexplained. Thank you very much for your support. If you want to make a comment about the show, suggest some future guests, let me know what you think about things, comment on past shows, that's absolutely fine. Just go to the website. You can send me an email through there and I get to see all of your email feedback. Also, vitally, if you can, please make a donation to the show to help me develop this concept. Like I say, we've got some pretty damn fine guests coming soon on The Unexplained. Thank you for keeping the faith. And until we meet again here, stay safe, stay calm, and stay in touch. My name is Howard Hughes. This has been The Unexplained. Take care.